大丈夫。
The presumptive title of this evening's lecture is The Father of the Prophets. I suspect that some of you have noticed that there's a cycle of consciousness that seems to interact with nature, with our surroundings. And whether people are conscious of it or unconscious of it, and some people are both totally unconscious of it and others are hyper-conscious of it, our psyches do actually respond to the changes in the natural world around us. I think that the time to read the Red Book is between October and May. That is actually when this all happened to dear Dr. Jung. Throughout my life, long before I figured out anything about psychology or even thought about figuring out anything about myself in psychology, I noticed a real change in my feelings and how I responded to my inner world and to my dreams come October. Things opened up. A dear old friend of mine by the name of John Ronald Reuel Tolkien, never met in life, but I spent a lot of time with the boy, said that October was the month when the elves were on the road. And it is noted that throughout Jung's life, it was in this fall time that things seemed to open up for him. Many of the important events, important images in his life came about in the fall time. And anyone who wants to sit around and read the Red Book after the 1st of May is a bit too crazy. You have to be crazy to want to read it first. But to sit around in spring weather and read it, now that is too crazy. So I think it's appropriate that we end our lectures on you and the Red Book in this month of May. In our last session, we finished wandering through hell with Dr. Jung. And there, at the end of that journey, he had proclaimed, "Who among the living is Christ and journeys to hell in living flesh? Who is it that expands the realm of Christ with hell? Who is it that is full of drunkenness while sober? Who is it that descended from being one into being two? Who is it that tore apart his own heart to unite what had been separated? I am he, the nameless one, who does not know himself, and whose name is concealed even from himself." Those words reflect an utter transformation in Carl Gustav Jung. I've read that passage many, many times now, and every time I read it, I tremble at what event, what thing this man had then seen. Jung had passed through hell. And so we're now at the end of the ninth adventure, to use the divisions that Jung used in his draft manuscript of Liber Novus. At this point, as you read the Red Book, you'll see that Jung is beginning to grasp the contours of this inner and entirely real world, to which he had sailed on his Nekke, his odyssey, into the underworld, into the unconscious. And he's beginning to get his bearings. He's differentiating the figures, the powers, and the realm to which he has descended, entered, the regions of his experience that he's meeting. We conceptualize the unconscious realm as an underworld or an inner world. And you'll remember that Jung first felt that he had to reach this place through an act of descent, digging. It seems, metaphorically, as we think about it, to be a place that's in or down. But as Jung discovered, once entered, the inner world has both aboves and belows. At times, Jung is hanging, literally hanging, in the middle of this above and below. And from this point on in the Red Book, you'll see a certain differentiation in his terminology with regard to the soul. He's now petitioning his soul in two fashions. One is like a bird, which can ascend upward and bring messages to him. The other is a serpent power, which descends into the instinctual or the phonic depths. Those differentiations he added to his text about 9 months later when he did his commentary. In his original diary, where it says serpent, bird, and this from the section on when he's petitioning, he used the word soul. But as he differentiated, he understood that he was actually petitioning different aspects of this inner messenger, inner relationship to soul, to ascend and to descend. Later in about 1916, as he recorded in his Black Book Journal 6, the soul specifically explained to him what was happening. She said to Jung, "If I am not conjoined through uniting of the below and the above, I break down into three parts." So the soul is saying, if I'm not integrated, I break down into three parts. The serpent. And in that, or some other animal form, I roam, living nature daimonically, arousing fear and longing. Second, the human soul, living forever within you. And then third, the celestial soul, as such, dwelling with the gods, far from you and unknown to you, appearing in the form of a bird. So throughout these latter parts of Liber Secundus, you'll find Jung addressing his soul in these distinct manifestations as serpent, as bird. He is now directing it to journey for him into upper and lower expanses that he personally cannot reach, and to bring back messages. Jung is caught between above and below, and his consciousness becomes the point of their conjunction, their integration. There are two sections that follow here that are important, and I'm not going to talk too much about them. I'm going to move on to a section called The Three Prophecies. This happens on January 22nd of 1914. And this is the single place I remember, at least at the moment I remember, in Liber Novus, where Jung specifies a date and time where something has happened. It was a moment of profound vision, in which he saw both the near and the distant destiny of humanity. And so I quote, "Wondrous things came nearer. I called my soul and asked her to dive down into the floods, whose distant roaring I could hear. This happened on 22 January 1914, as recorded in my Black Book." And again, I would add, I think this is the only place where he mentions specifically his journal. This was important to him. It happened on a day. He recorded it on that day in a journal. It was important enough that he's making those facts clear. and this is unusual, you won't find this elsewhere in the Red Book. As recorded in my Black Book. And thus she plunged into the darkness like a shot, and from the depths she called out, "Will you accept what I bring?" Jung, "I will accept what you give. I do not have the right to judge or to reject." The soul, "So listen. There is old armor and nasty, rusty gear of our fathers down here. Murderous leather trappings hang from them. Worm-eaten lance shafts, twisted spear heads, broken arrows, rotten shields, skulls, the bones of man and horse, old cannons, catapults, crumbling firebrands, smashed assault gear, stone spearheads, stone clubs, sharp bones, chipped arrowhead teeth. Everything the battles of yore have littered the earth with. Will you accept this?" Jung, "I accept it. You know better, my soul." Soul, "I find painted stones, carved bones with magical signs, talismanic sayings on hanks of leather and small plates of lead, dirty pouches filled with teeth, human hair and fingernails, timbers lashed together, black orbs, moldy animal skins, all the superstitions hatched by dark prehistory. Will you accept all this? Also this, if it must be, how can I judge?" Soul, "I find epidemics, natural catastrophes, sunken ships, razed cities, frightful feral savagery, famines, human meanness and fear, whole mountains of fear." Jung, "So shall it be, since you give it." Soul, "I find the treasures of all past cultures, magnificent images of gods, spacious temples, paintings, papyrus rolls, sheets of parchment with the characters of bygone languages, books full of lost wisdom, hymns and chants of ancient priests, stories told down the ages through thousands of generations." Jung, "That is an entire world whose extent I cannot grasp. How can I accept it?" Soul, "But you wanted to accept everything. Do you not know your limits? Can you not limit yourself?" Jung, "I must limit myself. Who could ever grasp such wealth?" Soul, "Be content and cultivate your garden with modesty." Jung, "I will. I see that it is not worth conquering a large piece of the immeasurable, but a smaller one instead. A well-tended small garden is better than an ill-tended large garden. Both gardens are equally small when faced with the immeasurable, but unequally cared for." And then the soul says to him, "Take shears and prune your trees." Jung wrote his commentary about 9 months later on this section. Remember, this prophecy that he had this vision he'd had on January 22nd, this was 1914. It was still 7 months, 8 months before World War I would erupt. At this period, Jung had no idea what was going on. He had no idea that what was happening to him, or at least no reason for believing what was happening to him, had larger societal, cultural implications. And he writes this commentary. From the flooding darkness the sun of the earth had brought, my soul gave me ancient things that pointed to the future. She gave me three things: the misery of war, the darkness of magic, and the gift of religion. To make comment, you can see how those things are in this series of materials that the soul had brought up from the depths. Okay, I return to his quote. If you are clever, you will understand that these three things belong together. These three mean the unleashing of chaos and its power, just as they also mean the binding of chaos. War is obvious, and everyone sees it. Magic is dark, and no one sees it. Religion is still to come, but it will become evident. Did you think that the horrors of such atrocious warfare would ever come over us? Did you think that magic existed? Did you think about a new religion? I sat up for long nights and looked ahead at what was to come, and I shuddered. Do you believe me? I'm not too concerned. What should I believe? What should I disbelieve? I saw, and I shuddered. But my spirit could not grasp the monstrous, could not conceive the extent of what was to come. The force of my longing languished, and powerless sank the harvesting hands. I felt the burden of the most terrible work of the times ahead. I felt the burden of the most terrible work of the times ahead. I saw where and how, but no word can grasp it. No will can conquer it. I could not do otherwise. I let it sink again into the depths. I cannot give it to you. I can speak only of the way of what is to come. Little good will come to you from outside. What will come to you lies within yourself. But what lies there? I would like to avert my eyes, close my ears, and deny all my senses. I would like to be someone among you who knows nothing, who never saw anything. It is too much and too unexpected. But I saw it. And memory will never leave me alone. But I saw it. And here he puts, there's a passage that appears in his journal as he wrote this night, which he did not put into the final copy of his manuscript in Liber Novus. That passage from the Black Book that continues here, that he excised, says, How can I fathom what will happen during the next 800 years, up to the time when the One begins his rule? I am speaking only of what is to come. Mark those words. Do you understand what he's saying here? He's just looked into a coming aeon of time, into a destiny, a human destiny. Or so he knows, whether we believe him or not. As he said, what do I believe? What do I disbelieve? That doesn't matter. I saw it. Then he continues, yet I curtail my longings, which would like to stretch out into the future, and I return to my small garden that presently blooms, whose extent I can measure. It shall be well tended. End quote. Now recall, this is a vision journal. And this is what he saw or experienced. And it is what led him to his own destiny. His garden was well tended. He had seen an image of the destiny of humanity, of a coming age. Accept this or not, as you will, it should be considered, because it may indeed be our destiny. War, magic, and religion. Those were the three prophecies. War. Well, this came to him, these visions that started this image. It came on January 22nd, and then he said, I sat for nights looking at this. There was a war coming, of course. But not just one. He saw a war. But if you think about it, the 20th century was a century of war, starting with the First War, the Great War, which we now call World War I. And then it was only 19 years later that the second phase of that conflict began and descended into Holocaust. You know, when Jung was seeing this, he wasn't just seeing the Great War, the first one. He was seeing a century leading up to Hiroshima, perhaps, and beyond, leading up, perhaps, to our time. The second prophecy was of magic. He saw magic. I can't claim to be certain about what he meant by that, because I'm not. Magic. Do any of you have an image of what the magic that threatens our world might be?
You know, I was trying to think of what Jung was referring to as you were speaking, and it sort of hit me. You know, there's a lot of kind of magic philosophy that's happening right now regarding, lack of a better way to define it, like the secret, you know, the secret, where you put out there what you want and it'll come to you. But it's sort of a manipulation of reality, of the material world, for one's own benefit. And I'm wondering if that's the association I was making in my mind as you were speaking.
No,
a lot of that is happening right now.
In history, Mag means great in Greek. Magus, the magic, is the great art, right? And traditionally, magic, at least in its Renaissance and medieval Renaissance history, and even up to now, has had two types. There's a what's called a goetic magic and a theurgic magic. The goetic magic was what we might think of as black magic. It was its intent was to manipulate forces of this earth to one's benefit. But there was also the high magic of the Renaissance, manifest in Christian Kabbalah, which was a theurgic magic. It was an attempt through magical processes to invoke communication with higher realms of consciousness or divinity. But you know, I'll confess. What I saw here in this magic is a type of goetic magic of the human creative process. This is the image that comes to me. Take your great-grandfather, who's probably dead. But if he were alive, think about it. Take him into your living room, sit him down in front of your plasma TV, and hand him your iPhone. Do the same to his father and mother and his mother. And his mother, 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 his mother's mother, mothers. You know, it only takes about 50 of those mothers to get back more than a millennia. Or more. You could take 100 mothers, your mothers, the mother you came from, the woman she came from, the earth she came from. You could put them in a room and in that room, even bigger than this room, you could have 100 such mothers. And in that room, each and every one of them would probably know at least one or two or three of the other women there and would have heard about two or three of the other women there. They would have something to talk about. That'd be one hell of an interesting gathering, wouldn't it? 100 of them. And how many years of history would that cover? 3,000? Okay, only in the last 20 or 30 years has the technos, the creative, imaginative ability of the human been so developed. And it is now growing exponentially. I'm a bit of a computer geek. I've been playing with electronic stuff since I was a kid, and I was a ham radio operator. I build my own computers. I have a half-built computer sitting on my dining room table right now that I'm going to go home and finish after this lecture. Okay? But, folks, look around you. Human attention is being sucked by a vampire. I walk through airports now, and I've been doing this for many years. 10 years ago, I saw people sitting in chairs reading books or talking to each other. Now you get on the Hertz rental car on the way out to the lot, every person in there is glued to their smartphone. I walk in to see patients in an emergency room. If they're under 30, they're sitting there texting and taking pictures of their broken leg, and I have to interrupt them. Excuse me, could we talk now? This is not a singular event. It's the norm. Our attention is being sucked outward by magic. By our magic. Where do these things come from? They come from our imagination. Our imagination thrust into the creative fire of this world. And it's taking our attention out of us. Magic is dangerous in this goetic sense, to the extent that it steals us from a moment alone with our own fact, with our own psyche, with the inner voice. If we're always hearing the ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling, or whatever smartphone ringer you've chosen as your personal signature in this world, you can't really look in. Magic. we are facing. We've been through a century of war. My own image, the image that comes to me, which I share as just a personal thought, is that we are facing a danger of great magic. And then he said, religion. It has not come yet, but it will. I'll leave any comment on that for later. Well, shortly after this, Jung's soul brought him a gift. She comes to him and says, "Do you hear something?" And Jung says, "Well, not really, maybe a little bell ringing in my left ear." And she says, "Look, it's come." And she says, "Well then, raise your hands and receive what comes to you." Jung replies, "What is it? A rod? A black serpent? A black rod formed like a serpent with two pearly eyes, a golden bangle around its neck? Is it not like a magical rod?" "Soul, it is a magical rod." Jung, "What should I do with magic? Is the magical rod a misfortune? Is magic a misfortune?" "Soul, yes, for those who possess it." "That sounds like the sayings of old. How strange you are, my soul. What should I do with magic?" "Soul, magic will do a lot for you." "I'm afraid that you're stirring up my desire and misunderstanding. You know that man never stops craving the black art and things that cost no effort." The dialogue goes on, and I'll not read the rest of it. This rod, this black rod, shaped like a serpent, is very much like the rod of Asclepius, the first physician. It is something like the serpent rod of Hermes. Jung is ambivalent about accepting this gift of magic. He has no idea what magic is. Eventually, he actually kneels down, accepts the rod, and then asks, "Where shall I put it?" And his answer is, "I will put it in my heart." He concludes this dialogue saying, "I bow my soul before unknown forces. I'd like to consecrate an altar to each unknown god. I must submit. The black iron in my heart gives me secret power. It's like defiance and like contempt of men." Okay. Jung had received a gift of magic. But what was magic? He needed help. He needed to find a magician to teach him about magic. About this time, he had a very interesting dream. He tells the story in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. You can read it there. It's a dream people heard about now for 50 years since Memories, Dreams, Reflections was published. And in the dream, he sees a old man with bull horns and the blue iridescent wings of a kingfisher bird flying through the sky. Except the sky is full of clods of earth. The sky looks like the ground, and the clouds look like earth. And he's holding in his hand a ring. One key in his hand, three keys hanging from the ring. He said the dream was so impressive that to cement it in his mind, he painted a picture of it. And I've seen that picture, but I cannot find it anywhere published. I would have brought a copy for you to see if I could have. The dream, he tells in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, he did not record in any journal that we now have available to us. So the date the dream occurred is not known, and it's not even known if he recorded it. It would be suspected that he would have, but that documentation has not come out of his archive at this point. On January 27th, about probably the time this dream occurred, Jung sought out this magical figure he had seen in dream, sought him out in vision. After a long search, he says, I found the small house in the country, fronted by a large bed of tulips. This is where Philemon, the magician, and his wife, Baucis, live. And then I quote onward. Philemon is one of those magicians who has not yet managed to banish old age, who lives it with dignity. And his wife can only do the same. Their interests seem to have become narrow, even childish. They water their bed of tulips and tell each other about the flowers that have newly appeared. And their days fade into a pale, waving chiaroscuro, lit up by the past, only slightly frightened of the darkness of what is to come. And in this first imaginative encounter with Philemon, he appears feeble, senescent, and of quite improbable aid. Something else you should also note in Liber Novus, Jung never writes Philemon's name in anything but Greek. Throughout the translation, you'll find Philemon written in Greek letters, and in the original transcription, Philemon always stands, his name stands in the Greek. Jung continues, why is Philemon a magician? Does he conjure up immortality for himself, a life beyond? He was probably only a magician by profession, and he now appears to be a pensioned magician who has retired from service. His desirousness and creative drive have expired, and he now enjoys his well-earned rest out of sheer incapacity, like every old man who can do nothing else than plant tulips and water his little garden. Philemon and Baucis. Where did Jung get those names? Philemon and Baucis. Well, there are two sources that undoubtedly came to Jung that must have influenced the image of Philemon and his wife, Baucis. Ovid, one of the three canonic poets of Latin classical literature, along with Virgil and Horace, told the story of Philemon and Baucis in Metamorphoses. And the story goes like this, very, very briefly, I abbreviate. Jupiter and Mercury, or Zeus and Hermes, had come to Earth. And they were seeking lodging, and they'd been turned away. They came to the house of a very poor old couple in the country. And this old man, an old woman, who kept the house, invited them in and gave them lodging. They had nothing except one goose. And to honor the guests, the wife, Baucis, went chasing after the goose to cut its neck off, pluck it, and feed these guests, these unknown guests. They did not know that these were gods. These were guests. The goose went running to Zeus and Hermes. And when they saw what this old couple were doing, that they were sacrificing their last earthly possession to feed these unknown guests, they revealed themselves to them and honored them and made of their house a temple, and of Philemon and Baucis, priest and priestess. This was a temple of those who gave entry, hospitality, and welcome to the gods. And when they died, Philemon and Baucis became two ancient and entwined trees. Well, the story appears again in Goethe's Faust. And I will call to your memory that Jung felt very deeply associated with Goethe and with his Faust. But the story goes a little bit differently. A little bit differently in Goethe's telling. Faust is expanding his development of the world. Putting in, shall we say, a new suburban townhouse development. Needed to clear some land. But there was an old couple that had a house and property named Philemon and Baucis. And they were in the way of this development. So Faust talks to Mephistopheles and asks him to do something about this. Well, Mephistopheles finds this easy enough. He murders them. And the subdivision goes up. Jung took that story very personally. Faust, in his hubris, in his extroversion of creative powers, had destroyed the place, the dwelling, of those who had given refuge, welcome to the gods. At the end of this first session of visions, which comes to the end really in May, in this merry month of May, in 1914, in this session, who Philemon was, this old senescent magician, who he was, remained unclear to Jung. And in fact, at the very end of Liber Secundus, you'll find some very ambivalent statements where Jung talks about Philemon as a deceiver. He hasn't really got it down. Who he is. But as Jung then goes back and works through his recension of the material, he starts to understand that Philemon is in fact a force behind each and every one of these prior figures. Philemon is a shapeshifter. Philemon is not just one. Philemon is a multiplicity of experiences and encounters. And then finally, Jung pens in Liber Novus this incredible ode to Philemon. It goes on for several pages. When you read that, you should understand that that ode to that tribute to Philemon is written much later, after Jung has developed a relationship with Philemon. It's probably, in my view, it's probably written about 1916 when he was transcribing this material. I don't think this section is in the draft. I haven't had a chance to ask Sonu specifically about this, but he says things in this which indicate that this was not written in the primary draft in 1915, but was probably written around 1916 or even 1917. And this is what he says. This expresses Jung's later understanding of who Philemon was. You know, O Philemon, the wisdom of things to come. Therefore, you are old. Oh, so very ancient. And just as you tower above me in years, so you tower above the present in futurity. And the length of your past is immeasurable. You are legendary and unreachable. You were and will be, returning periodically. Your wisdom is invisible, your truth is unknowable, entirely untrue in any age, and yet true in all eternity. But you pour out living water from which the flowers of your garden bloom. A starry water, a dew of the night. End quote. And that's just a tiny fragment of this, a long tribute to Philemon. In Memories, Dreams, Reflections, Jung hints at the nature of his relationship to Philemon. Once again, a text that's been available for more than a half century. And this is what Jung said, quote, "Philemon and other figures of my fantasies brought home to me the crucial insight that there are things in the psyche which I do not produce. The crucial insight that there are things in the psyche which I do not produce." Hopefully those words would not be so alien to you at this point. But believe me, over the last half century, as people have read that book, a lot of individuals have wondered what the hell Jung could be talking about. Things I do not produce in the psyche? I don't create them? They have independent existence? Well, yes. That is what Philemon taught you. And he goes on to say, things in the psyche which I do not produce, but which produce themselves and have their own life. Philemon represented a force which was not myself. Philemon represented superior insight. He was a mysterious figure to me. At times he seemed to me quite real, as if he were a living personality. I went walking up and down the garden with him. And to me he was what the Indians call a guru. And no one really took that literally over these years. I mean, not many. I did, actually, from the very beginning. But I'm a bit strange. Went walking up and down the garden with Philemon. Are you getting that? This guy's walking around his garden with a spook, and he's calling him his master and guru, and he's as real as a living person. Well, that made immediate sense to me, but it also seemed entirely crazy. And over 25 years of giving lectures about this material, I've told that story many times, and I just see very peculiar looks on people's faces, and something is scratching their head. Well, let me continue. Let me give you Jung's description of Philemon. This is the picture that Jung painted of Philemon in the Red Book. At the top, in Greek letters, there's an inscription. 25 years ago, I saw it, because this was, maybe it would have been 19, this painting was published in some books. There's a book called Jung in Word and Image, I think, that has this picture, and a few others. A couple pictures from the Red Book, and this was one of them. And I saw that inscription probably 25 years ago when it was first published. And you know what it says? Beloved Philemon, father of the prophets. Father of the prophets. So this is what Jung said around 1923 to a young woman by the name of Carrie F. Baines. Carrie was a young doctor. I've mentioned her previously. She was, well, not so young then. She was one of the first women physicians graduating from Johns Hopkins, and I believe she graduated around 1910. I could be off a couple years on that. She married a fellow by the name of Jaime de Angulo, who was a very strange anthropologist, and they lived in the Big Sur in the 1910 to 1920 period. It was a wild time. Eventually, Carrie ran away, took her daughter and ran away to Zurich, left Jaime. About 1922, went to Jung to analysis with Jung. And she was an amazing woman. She describes herself as a complete rational. She never had any entry into the unconscious. She never was able to do active imagination, that sort of stuff. But she knew Jung. And Jung really liked her. And they had a very interesting interaction. And Carrie kept journals of all of her talks with Jung during this critical period, 1922, 23 onward. It's Carrie, actually, who was the translator of the I Ching, which some of you have seen. She did that in the 30s on through the 50s. It took her quite a few years to do that translation. So Carrie kept these journals, and they came to light. Sonu found Carrie's daughter, and now all of Carrie's material, Carrie Fink de Angela Baines' journals, Dr. Carrie Fink de Angela Baines, journals are now being cataloged at the University College London, and Sonu says they'll soon be on public access there for researchers who wish to go read them. And every excerpt I've seen of this material is just amazing. Well, anyway, 1923, Jung is talking to Carrie about the Red Book. He's in consideration of publishing it. And this is what she went home and wrote. And once again, remember, when Carrie writes these, she writes them as if she's writing a letter back to Jung about what they had been talking about. So she addresses him as you and then gives her own statements. So, quote, from Carrie's journal in 1923. You told me then something more of your own attitude toward the Red Book. You said some of it hurt your sense of fitness of things, terribly, and that you had shrunk from putting it down as it came to you, but that you had started on the principle of voluntariness, that is, of making no corrections, and so you had stuck to that. Some of the pictures were absolutely infantile, but were intended so to be. There were various figures speaking. Elias, Father Philemon, etc. But all appeared to be phases of what you thought ought to be called the Master. You were sure that this latter was the same who inspired Buddha, Mani, Christ, Mohammed, all those who may be said to have communed with God. Are you getting that? This is how Jung was meeting this figure. You were sure that this master, this latter, was the same who had inspired Buddha, Christ, Mani, Mohammed, all those who may be said to have communed with God. And then Carrie continues. But the others had identified with him. They had identified with him. You absolutely refused to. It could not be for you, you said. You had to remain a psychologist. The person who understood the process. Let me step back and make comments. So you see, Jung is having this experience of a thing he calls the master, who he feels is the same type of force, archetypal if you call it, but experienced fact, coming in visionary form, with whom he can walk and talk. He felt this was the same sort of fact which had been the inspiration of those who called themselves prophets or inspired ones, enlightened ones. But the difference was, historically, many of these people had identified with the figure. Jung felt that his hermeneutic, his interpretive process, had to be different. The experience was real. He's not belittling the experience. It was genuine, and it had the savor of divinity, of communication with unseen, perhaps unknowable realms. But he had to approach it as a psychologist. And I continue. The person who understood the process. Carrie says, I said then that the thing to be done was to enable the world to understand the process. Also, without getting the notion that they had the master caged as if it were at their beck and call. They had to think of him as a pillar of fire perpetually moving on forward out of human grasp. Yes, you said, it was something like that. Perhaps it cannot yet be done. And then Carrie adds this note. As you talked, I grew more and more aware of the immeasurability of the ideas which are filling you. You said they had the shadow of eternity upon them. And I could feel the truth of it. End quote. The same who inspired Buddha, Mani, Christ, Muhammad. All those who may be said to have communed with God. And so above Philemon's painting here, on page 154 of Liber Novus, there is that appellation, Philemon. Beloved Philemon, father of the prophets. About the time Jung painted this mural in the Red Book. Remember, the paintings in the transcription took years and years. Jung got around to painting Philemon in the Red Book around 1924. About the same time, 1923, he began constructing his tower at Bollingen, his retreat. And as he built the tower, he actually slowed down and then eventually stopped working, transcribing manuscript material into the Red Book. Next to that picture I have behind me here of Philemon, right to the side of that in the original manuscript, if you go home and look at your Red Book, you'll see that there's another inscription that Jung has put in the margin. It comes from the Bhagavad Gita. And this is what it says. And I quote, and I should also add, this is the only text in the Red Book in English. Okay? Jung writes, the Bhagavad Gita says, whenever there is a decline of the law and an increase in iniquity, then I put forth myself for the rescue of the pious and for the destruction of the evildoers. For the establishment of the law, I am born in every age. This is the great declaration of the avatar. This is Krishna instructing Arjuna concerning the nature of truth and the avatar, the one who returns in every age when there is a need. And then, when Jung had completed the tower, the first tower structure, the stone tower he built in Bollingen, he took out his chisel and his hammer, and he carved an inscription in the stone over the doorway of his tower. 1923. And this is what he's carved there. Philemonos sacrum, Fausti poenitentia. Philemon's shrine, Faust's repentance. Faust's repentance. Philemon's shrine, Faust's repentance. What was Faust's repentance? Faust had murdered those who had given home, place, acceptance, honor, welcome to the gods. This was Philemon's shrine. Jung was repenting. The Faustian force of modern conscious development. Faust's repentance. But this deepening understanding of Philemon, it came in only the next few years after this initial encounter. In the initial encounter during the winter of 1914, Philemon was simply a mysterious old magician, a strange dream figure with blue wings of a kingfisher, holding a key. And at the ending, as I mentioned, of Liber Secundus, you'll see there is some ambivalence about him. Well, this brings us pretty much to the end of Liber Secundus. There are other things I could talk about, and I'm not going to. Because I don't have time. And it's May. We're done. But at this point, Jung put a finis end on his handwritten manuscript of the material. It really runs through April of 1914. This material he was going to put into the first and second book of Liber Novus. But his journal didn't end. In April and May, it goes on. And you'll find this section, now this part was in a manuscript called Scrutinies. Jung wrote Scrutinies around 1918. He realized that there was more. He wasn't done in 1916 like he thought he was. This stuff just kept coming. So he wrote another manuscript called Scrutinies. And in this, he put in the part of that material that he'd left out of the original manuscript about what had happened in April and May, and then the visions begin again in fall of 1915. And in those first sections of Scrutinies, you have to remember that is still this first year. There is some intense self-criticism. He is shedding his skin. He's throwing off false masks of his ego, and he's struggling to understand what it was that had been happening to him. On April 20th of 1914, he resigned his presidency of the International Psychoanalytic Association. 10 days later, he resigned his academic position at the University of Zurich. He could not be part of that. Something else was calling him. Jung was alone on his solitary path. By the summer of 1914, as I said, the flood of imagination stopped. It ebbed off as the sun filled the sky, as the night hours shortened. And the visions ended. But there was a dream that happened in the spring and early summer of 1914 that is told in Memories, Dreams, Reflections that I should tell you. And I'll read it to you. In the spring and early summer of 1914, I had a thrice repeated dream that in the middle of summer, an Arctic cold wave descended and froze the land to ice. I saw, for example, the whole of the Lorraine and its canals frozen, and the entire region totally deserted by human beings. All living green things were killed by frost. This dream came in April and May, and for the last time in June of 1914. In the third dream, frightful cold had again descended from out of the cosmos. The dream, however, had an unexpected end. There stood a leaf-bearing tree, but without fruit. My tree of life, I thought, whose leaves had been transformed by the effects of the frost into sweet grapes full of healing juices. I plucked the grapes and gave them to a large waiting crowd. I plucked the grapes and gave them to a large waiting crowd. My tree of life. I continue. At the end of July 1914, I was invited by the British Medical Association to deliver a lecture on, quote, the importance of the unconscious in psychopathology, unquote, at a congress in Aberdeen, Scotland. I was prepared for something to happen, for such visions and dreams are fateful. In my state of mind just then, with fears that were pursuing me, it seemed fateful to me that I should have to talk on the importance of the unconscious at such a time. And he was in Aberdeen doing these lectures when World War I erupted. And then he continues and says, on August 1, the World War broke out. Now my task was clear. I had to try to understand what had happened and to what extent my own experience coincided with that of mankind in general. This work took precedence over everything else. Jung had a garden to tend. Let's stop there for the first half, and then I'll see if I can squeeze everything I need to into the last half.